So who wants to work today? I didn't think so. With the summer vacation season over, many workers are trying to cope with having their noses to the grindstone once again. And in this edition of On Your Money, we'll talk about what's stressing us out at work and how we can relax. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Plus, On Your Money's financial planner, Kevin McKinley, will also have some advice on choosing and paying for long-term care costs, paying down student loans and saving for retirement at the same time, and saving money on your TV entertainment bills, and answers to your personal finance questions. What's yours? 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, and he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
And welcome back from vacation.
Thank you very much. It's good to be back.
Yeah, and you got your nose to the grindstone today?
I'm just actually applying that last batch of cocoa butter to my tan. I set the base, and now I'm more in maintenance mode.
Well, I feel like playing on the drums all day. I don't know about you, Kevin. So summer's over, and a lot of us are back to work. Some of us might have had some extended vacation during the summertime. Are you feeling the stress of work now that summer is behind us?
I was clever enough to start working at the age of 14 and never stop now at the age of 47. And so this is normal for me. And I'm not complaining, but I'm in a constant state of stress in part of due to the career that I've chosen. But the American Psychological Association says that I am not alone. Job stress and job pressure is the number one cause of stress in the United States, ahead of money and health issues. And the improving economy is not helping. According to the APA's survey results, a third of workers report chronic stress, meaning the stress is always there all the time. And a lot of people might say, well, you know, but the economy is getting better, so this isn't as big of an issue anymore. 92% of workers, according to Right Management, say that they have more stress right now than they did 5 years ago when the recession began.
Well, what's stressing us out so much?
Some longer-term issues like lower and limited pay, meaning that people aren't getting what they think they should be getting or what they need to get. Also, lack of advancement. They don't see a great future of progression in their current jobs, kind of a ceiling over where they can go. But I think it's one of the issues is the phrase that a lot of people are saying and a lot of people are hearing, depending on where you are in the workplace hierarchy, and that is, we need to do more with less.
Yeah.
And everyone's hearing that. No one's saying we need to do less with more. Everyone is saying we need to do more with less. And there has been an increase in productivity. Productivity is typically measured the amount of goods and services produced per hour work, but it's coming at the expense of current workers. The Economic Policy Institute says that from 1973 to 2011, productivity went up 80%. But real wages only went up 10%. Now, part of that is because employers are giving workers more tools, such as computers, to do their jobs more effectively, but the workers aren't participating as much in the wages as they are contributing in the productivity.
So what are the experts saying when it comes to how we can deal with job-related stress?
Well, we'll get to the experts in a minute, but I think I know what the issue is here. I'm a big fan of the television show Mad Men. And one of the reasons I took the job that I did is because when I was a little boy and was home watching television during the day, I noticed on soap operas that if you were a business person, you know, you wore a tie to work, and you were sitting in your office and your secretary buzzed you and said, Mr. McKinley, Mr. Johnson is here to see you. Send him in. He'd walk in, and the first thing I'd say to him is, hi, Bob, do you need a drink? And you had booze not only hidden in your drawer, but right out on the counter.
Yeah, and you still do that today, don't you?
Well, here's the problem. Not only are we not doing that, but we're doing the opposite. We're drinking more and more coffee, which is adding to the agitation and the stress. So maybe we should go dial back on the stimulants and dial up on the depressants a little bit. But what some of the techniques that are recommended to do this, first of all, if you're just sitting there and your coworker's bugging you or customer's bugging you or your manager's bugging you, whatever, pretend you are sipping on a straw and make your mouth that shape, and then draw breath in that way, and then send it out your nasal passages. And do that 3 or 4 times. That's a very good relaxation tip. If you have the time and the ability, go for a little walk during your lunch hour rather than wolfing down a burger. You might also want to clean up your environment, your work environment, get it as orderly and neat as you possibly can. And here's something that the Academy of Management Journal said really was effective in helping people deal with workplace stress. At the end of the day, write down the things that went positive for you and not just, yeah, I got paid. Write down some accomplishments, write out some things that lucked out and went well for you, and then put with those why those felt good to you. And they found that that was a significant reductor in stress for workers. And as part of that, too, you might also want in the notebook, isolate the things that bothered you. And so that you can go back in this notebook or this diary, this journey, and see some consistent things that stress you out, and then isolate them and discuss it with your coworkers, your supervisors, and see if there's a way you can solve or eliminate those stressors.
Well, good advice, Kevin. What if we do those breathing exercises and journaling and cut back on the coffee and it still doesn't work?
Start looking around. First of all, look at other people's jobs. See what other people are doing. Guess what they're getting paid to do it, and think if maybe your job isn't quite that stressful and you're getting paid more for work that's not as difficult. But also look around at other jobs for yourself, and one of several things will happen. You may find that there's nothing better out there for you, and then you might appreciate and be able to tolerate the job you have a little more. Or if you do find that there is a better job that provides either more income or less stress or both, you might take that job. Or at least it might give you leverage in your current position so that you can get more of what you want out of your current job from your employer. And next week we're going to talk with you about how you can do that.
Sounds good. We have a caller on job stress. So let's go to Tim in West Allis. Hi, Tim.
Yes. Hi, Kevin. Sometimes I wonder if we talk about this stuff just too much. I mean, a good level of stress keeps you motivated. People that don't seem to have stress don't just seem to get a lot done. Sometimes they aren't very motivated. And I just wonder if a lot of it is just self-induced. It's about attitude. I mean, it's how you approach things. And I sometimes I think we just talk about this stuff too much. It's the way life is. You know, you got to, or as I say sometimes in the immortal words of Stevie Winwood, sometimes you just got to roll with it, baby.
It's very true. I do think that one of the issues, and I've done this for 25 years, and I have a lot of intimate talks with people from all different walks of life about what they do for a living and how much they like their job or don't like it or how desperate they are to retire. And I agree with Tim. I do think that that's one of the reasons we get paid, is to handle the stress from some other area, whether it's a customer, coworker, supervisor, whatever. I also think that one of the biggest issues that helps people alleviate stress on the job is control. The opportunity to do what you think needs to be done to do the job effectively and not be at the beck and whim, or is it beck and whim, is that right, of every single person who you come in contact with during the day. And the more people can figure out ways to get control over what they do during the day, usually the less stress they have.
Yeah, and I might say that there's stress and then there's chronic stress that can also kill you. So
yeah, it definitely can, and it can. And we're going to talk a little bit about that next week. But it really is an issue of, it obviously affects your health, and we spend most of our waking hours in our adult lifetime doing some kind of work, whether it's at home or at an employer. And so that constant grind and that constant undercurrent can really damage not only your health, but also your outlook on life. So it is very important to figure out how to deal with it. Sometimes you can't eliminate it, and sometimes, like Tim and Steve Winwood said, you do have to roll with it.
Well, you'll be proud of me, Kevin. I did tell Christy Taylor today that she did not have to make my third pot of coffee, so I'm cutting back.
Still had to give you the foot rub, but didn't have to make the pot of coffee.
Oh, that's good. I'll have to remember that. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. You should consult with your financial advisor prior to making any investment decisions. And with that being said, if you have a personal finance question that you would like Kevin's take on, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org.
Oh, yes, wait a minute, Mr. Boatman.
And it is time now for the On Your Money email bag. And a listener named Weston says, "Hi, Kevin and Joy. I really enjoy listening to your program. And I'm very thankful for the audio archives because I can't always make it on Tuesday mornings." He goes on to say that he's married with two young children and his family has some federal student loans to repay. But he also says that he'd like to balance the repayment with saving for retirement in a Roth 401k at his workplace. And he wants to know, Kevin, which one should be the top priority?
Well, repayment of those loans is obviously mandatory, but because they are federal student loans, not only can and he should make the minimum payment, he may be able to lower that minimum payment through what is known as the income-based repayment plan, and it's an opportunity for people with lower income to reduce or possibly even eliminate at some point the payments on their federal student loans, and it's available at IBRinfo.org, IBRinfo.org, and we'll put that link up at OnYourMoney.com later on today, too.
And once they've lowered and covered the minimum monthly payment?
That's when they can start saving for retirement, and I would actually prefer that he use a Roth IRA. And if he's married and under 50, not only can he put in up to $5,500 of his earnings into that Roth IRA, but he can put it in for a spouse, even if she isn't working, just working at home. You don't get a tax break on the contributions, but because by definition they're probably in a lower income tax bracket, sacrificing that tax break isn't really a big deal. The neat thing about it, of course, is that they can withdraw the contributions back out of the Roth IRA at any time. So if they're in kind of a precarious financial position, that can serve as kind of a rainy day fund for an emergency or to pay for college down the road for these kids. And best of all, if you don't need the money in the Roth IRA and it's still there in retirement, you can pull it out tax-free.
So why do you suggest the Roth IRA instead of the Roth 401k?
There's more control over it. First of all, he can pick from myriad, and I want to note that I use that word appropriately and properly, investments in the Roth IRA, whereas the Roth 401k, he's limited to just the roster of investments that his employer is providing for it. And also, he can get easier access to the money. Technically, you can pull money from a Roth 401k, but the Roth IRA is easier to get to by just pulling money out and designating it as a contribution. The neat thing about the Roth 401k is at least it's coming out of his paycheck, and for a lot of us, that's easier to handle when it's, you know, $50 per paycheck rather than having to come up with a check to make a contribution to a Roth IRA. But you can do that. You can have you can open a Roth IRA and you can have money deducted from your checking account or your savings account on an automatic basis, and it could be as low as $25 per deduction. Now, for some of us, that's too much work, so the Roth 401k is better. But still, I'm partial to the Roth IRA.
All right. Thanks, Weston, for that email. And thanks to Weston for bringing up the audio archives because it gives me a reason to plug the new and improved WPR.org website. Have you checked out how pretty it is, Kevin?
Oh, let me check right now.
Okay. Is that the computer, what sound it makes?
That's the modem.
Right. Oh, that's the modem. Okay. Well, anyway, listeners can go to WPR.org and check out the new and improved look of the website. And you can listen to programs. If you can't listen live, we have audio archives of all of our shows. And you can listen at your convenience. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are here live every Tuesday morning between 8 and 9. The program is rebroadcast on Tuesday nights, and it's also rebroadcast on Sunday mornings from 7 until 8 on Sunday mornings. So if you're listening on Tuesday night or on Sunday morning, this is a rebroadcast. But you can always send a question. Maybe it'll be used for the On Your Money email bag in a future program to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Or you can call us right now at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. If you have a personal finance question for Kevin McKinley. Kevin is a certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley talking about your money. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Coming up, we will have some information and advice on choosing and paying for long-term care costs and also saving some money on your television entertainment bills. Now to your questions for Kevin. We'll start with Matt in Waukesha. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
Hi, Joy. Hi, Kevin. This is Matt. So my question is pretty simple. My grandmother recently passed away and surprisingly had a little bit of an estate left behind, and her trust is going to be sending me some money, and I wasn't expecting it. So I've already got pretty aggressive 401k investments and 529s for my kids. My question really is, how do I minimize the tax implications of getting a distribution from a trust like this?
Have you been told for sure, Matt, that there are tax implications from the trust distribution?
No, not for sure. I think they might cover the taxes, but then again, I wasn't sure if I'd be having to put them down as like normal income on my tax form this year.
No, generally in this situation, and depending on the type of asset, but generally what happens is if there are any taxes, and I doubt there will be, they're usually covered by the estate and paid for by the estate, and especially if it is only an inheritance issue. Now, sometimes when people can receive money in the manner that you have and still owe taxes, is their income taxes, because the money was in an IRA and you took the money out of their IRA on a decedent basis, or there it was in an annuity, a tax-deferred annuity, and you pulled the money out as well. But if it is in a trust like that and it's not an income distribution, it's unlikely that you'll have any tax bill. Are you maxing out your at-work 401k contributions right now, Matt?
I've been at 10% ever since my first job, so okay. I'm doing a pretty good job, and there's company matching on that.
Okay.
I could probably do a couple more percent, but, you know, not much, so.
Okay, what you mean not much in the sense you couldn't afford it, or not much in the sense that you've reached the limits allowed by law?
I think there's maybe a max of like 12% or 14% on the total 401k contributions. But
okay,
as far as my budget, I want to keep it where it is. So.
Okay, it's about 17.5 and 23.5 if you're over age 50. Or your earnings, whichever is less. But I would check with your HR department. That's the quickest way to lower your tax bill, is by ramping up your at-work retirement plan contributions. And if you need to use the inheritance money to cover the reduction in your paycheck, that's a great way to do it.
Cool. Good idea.
All right. Thanks, Matt, for the call. Good luck. We have now Jim in Neillsville with us. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Yes, good morning. I have a question about the tax deductibility of the traditional IRA. It seems a lot better than the Roth IRA. I'm self-employed, so I'm at about a 40% tax rate. So if I put $4,000 into my IRA, basically the government is contributing about $1,500 of it.
This is true, and it's a great point, and it's one of the easiest ways to make money is to pay less legally in taxes. Jim, in that high tax bracket, though, and as a self-employed person, have you ever considered opening up a self-employed business owner's retirement plan?
Yes. If I had more money, I would do it.
Okay, got it. Yeah, the IRA is the best way to go about it, and because you are a self-employed business owner, and because your cash flow is probably critical, even though the business might be doing very well, it's likely that you're learning to live not necessarily paycheck to paycheck, but you're not an extravagant spender, correct?
Right.
Okay, and this is how small business owners actually get rich. They go decades, if they're fortunate, and they never know what the business is going to bring in versus what it's going to cost. And so they become very frugal, and they develop very frugal habits. And then, of course, once they're ready to retire, they hopefully sell the business. There's value from it. But because they've developed such frugal habits, they don't need very much in retirement. And all that money just kind of sits there, and they couldn't spend it if they wanted to. That's also the entire Depression generation financial security was built upon that principle. So here's the nice thing about that. Because you probably have fairly frugal habits, you won't need a lot of income in retirement, and therefore you'll get this nice big tax deduction now on your IRA contribution. And because you'll have not a huge need for income in retirement, you also won't have a huge income tax bill, and therefore when you are taxed on it, it'll probably be at a much lower rate than what you're deferring on it right now. So yes, I agree with you completely.
Thank you very much.
All right, Jim, thanks for the call. We have Jackie in Platteville now. Hi, Jackie, you're on the air.
Hi. My question was, we've gotten some conflicting advice about whether it's better if you have a mortgage. We're in our late 50s, and whether you have a mortgage, whether you should pay that off and try to have no mortgage by the time you retire, or whether it's better to keep that as a tax break and put your extra money into a Roth IRA instead.
Jackie, just one question. First-time listener?
Yes.
Okay, good. I'm glad you asked this question. It's an eternal question, and even when I have clients who we go over this issue and talk about it, and we reach a decision on it, and then in 6 months they come back and go, what was that you said again about paying off the mortgage? I don't know about that. And part of it is because debt feels bad to everyone. But debt is a tool, and debt can be a dangerous tool if used improperly, but it can be a very useful tool if used properly. And in your case, Jackie, do you know what the interest rate is roughly on that mortgage?
It's like 3.5.
Okay. I've said this for a very long time, and I may finally be proven right. I'm never wrong, but I'm just often early. That could be the lowest interest rate you ever get to borrow, at which you get to borrow money. Yeah, at which you get to borrow money in your lifetime, Jackie. And not only that, but any money that you do save, there's a good possibility that in the next few years, that bank or credit union that was kind enough to give you that mortgage at 3.25 or whatever, you may be able to go back in there with technically the money they lent you and say, hey, I see you're offering a CD at 4%. I'll take that out. And so you've basically borrowed money from them at 3.25 or whatever, and you're lending it back to them at 4%. And even if that doesn't happen, you save much more money. Are you maxing out your at-work retirement plans, like your pre-tax 401ks?
Almost.
Okay. I'd love you to max those out first. Do you have any big expenses coming up, like college or home improvement or buying a new car, anything like that?
Not really, no.
Okay. I'd still rather have you just park that money aside and pay the mortgage off as slowly as you possibly can. And then when you get to retirement, and if you have so much money you don't even know what to do with it anymore, and interest rates aren't higher than what you're paying on the mortgage, and you don't see any prospective health issues where you might need a emergency cash of cash, then go ahead and pay it off. But otherwise, you're very fortunate to have that mortgage, and I wouldn't get rid of it anytime soon.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks, Jackie. I swear we could do a show on that every week.
And I think we do.
Sometimes, but it's something that a lot of people wonder about. So thanks very much for the call. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. Kevin's a certified financial planner, and he is here with information and advice on your money. And we welcome your personal finance questions of any kind at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Time now for smart assets. When confronted with paying for potential long-term care costs, some ways are wiser than others. And how do you figure that out, Kevin?
Well, the decision often depends on how much money you have, how much liquid assets you have. If you have less than, say, roughly $200,000 or so, especially in this environment, you probably can't afford the premiums unless you have a very big pension and Social Security check coming in. If you have more than $2 million, you probably have enough money that you can self-insure, meaning write a check for any long-term care costs that you or someone you love may incur. Long-term care insurance is an option best suited for people somewhere in between $200,000 and $2 million in assets. Again, it's not for everybody, but it's best for those who are worried about it and say, like a lot of insurance, having it makes them feel better and makes them sleep better at night. And then that's worth looking at. But there's a third group of people who have the money, but they are looking to have Medicaid pay for their care. They're going to take strategies and steps in hand so that they can hopefully qualify for Medicaid.
So how do you go about doing that?
Well, typically what they do is they try to remove their assets from the equation. It's very difficult to do. Sometimes they try to give it to family members, or they purchase what's known as a Medicaid immediate annuity, or they place their assets in an irrevocable trust. Now, all these things are technically possible. but they all have their downside, and they must be done in many cases well in advance. Typically, if a person goes into a nursing home and is trying to qualify for Medicaid, right now they look back 60 months to see what you did with your money and any money that was given away within the last 60 months before you try to enter the nursing home and qualify for Medicaid can be brought back into the equation. And even if you said, well, I gave it away, they said, well, that's too bad. You still have to use that cash to pay for it before you can qualify for any Medicaid. And also with all of these strategies, the money is gone from the control of the original owner and the person who's trying to qualify for Medicaid. You know, it goes to a family member or trust or insurance company, but it's gone. And it has to be gone in most cases well in advance of when you're trying to qualify for this.
That sounds like that might be one of the options that's not as wise as another.
No, you can maybe tear it up into little pieces, too. That's another good way to qualify for Medicaid. A better solution, though, is there's a special kind of long-term care insurance policy. It's called a partnership policy. And what you do is you buy this particular kind of long-term care insurance. And the amount of long-term care that the insurance pays lets you keep an equal amount of your own assets and still qualify for Medicaid. So let's say you had a policy that pays let's say $3,000 a month for 5 years of care. So that's 60 times $3,000, and I'm going to carry the $780,000. That would allow you to qualify for Medicaid and still keep $180,000 of your assets after all of your other assets were used up. So you kind of get your money and keep it too. And the partnership policies aren't greatly wildly more expensive than a normal policy.
So where do people go to find these special kinds of long-term care insurance policies?
It's typically state-specific. Wisconsin does offer it. So if you do have a favored insurance agent, you can contact him or her. But in Wisconsin, you can also go to the Office of the Commissioner of Insurance at oci.wi.gov and look up LT Partnership. And again, we'll have a link to that link at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on. And that it's a great resource because it not only talks about the ins and outs of these policies, but it gives you a listing of all the insurance companies that sell this kind of policy in the state of Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call from Sally in Sun Prairie. Hi, Sally.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question along the lines of the long-term care insurance. My husband and I are approaching 60, and we fall right within that category. But the premiums and the risk that it won't be there when we need it kind of make us uneasy. So we're wondering about a product we've been hearing about called life insurance with living benefits.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if get your opinion on that, and I can take my call off the air.
Sure.
And I'm sorry, I didn't heap a lot of praise on, but I'm a little nervous about it.
I have that effect on people, so it's not a good thing. But no, and it's a great question. And I'm actually not completely against this notion. What it is you put some money into an insurance company's product. And what they say to you is they say, okay, we're going to pay you 3% a year, let's just say, on this money, kind of a fixed rate annuity. And then if you or the insured die, we're going to give you four times the amount of money that you put in, or we're going to give you two times this amount. It's kind of a bank account that you can use for long-term care coverage in the future. And it still has some of the problems of long-term care insurance because you don't know what the insurance company is going to be able to pay, if they're going to be around to pay you, et cetera. But at least it gives you some kind of flexibility so you're not just paying in every single month for 30 years and then you die like most people want to, which is in their sleep at a ripe old age, and don't ever get the benefit back for it. Now, I argue that long-term care insurance shouldn't be looked upon in that manner. It should be looked upon like homeowners insurance, where so far in 2013, I paid quite a bit of money in homeowners insurance premiums, but my house hasn't burned down. So I don't look upon that as a bad thing. I look upon it protecting me if a bad thing happens. But a lot of people look at long-term care and say, oh, gosh, I'm paying all this money and I don't even want to go to the nursing home. Even if I do go to a nursing home, I'm not going to enjoy cashing in this policy. Well, if you look at it and say, we're going to pay this on a month-to-month basis, and hopefully we won't need it, but if we do, it's there for us. But if you can't stand that notion, like Sally says, I'm okay with this particular kind of product. I wouldn't put all of your money into it, but as a small portion of kind of a hedge, I'm all right with it.
Well, Sally, thanks very much for the call, and it's good intentions that count with that.
Absolutely.
False praise, so that's good. Now, she was worried about the risk of a long-term care insurance policy not being around, and you've talked about that in the past, Kevin. are these special kinds of long-term care insurance policies at that same risk?
That's a good question, and no, you still have the same issue. What's happening is a lot of people who got into providing long-term care insurance many years ago, they didn't charge enough for it, and more people have kept the policies than what they expected, and people are living longer. We've gotten better at maintaining most of the body when the brain goes, and therefore they need the care that this insurance provides. And so a lot of companies are not only not offering it, but they're getting out of the business and only serving customers who have existing policies. And that's going to change, and it means that people are going to experience big increases in their premiums. They already are, mm-hmm. but it's going to happen even more the longer they keep it. And that's why it's a little nicer to say, well, we have this insurance policy. We have a premium that's due for this month. Can we afford it? Yes. Do we need the insurance? Yes. Do we want the insurance? Yes. Okay, then let's send in this check. And now we've got 30 days of coverage. And we'll ask ourselves the same question 30 days from now.
We'll go now to Robert in Stevens Point, who has a question. Hi, Robert.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I have a question. I'm 70 years old. I'm single. I have a home that's approximately $300,000 in value and a half interest in the agricultural property, which is another $150,000. And there's cash and equities, which are taken care of with TODs or PODs. But in as much as I'm 70, I need to think about transferring this home and this land to my children when I pass. There's also a Mexican home as well, but you probably aren't familiar with Mexico, and neither am I, as a matter of fact.
I'll take it, Robert. It's okay.
So you want to know how to set everything up to avoid estate taxes? Is that it?
Yes, that's what I'm talking about.
Okay. Well, your background defines you, Robert, as a great candidate for a new service we're considering, which is the OnYourMoney.com dating site. We want to find like-minded people who want to be together, and you've got a great profile, so you could be a very good example for it. I have good news for you. Unless your estate is worth millions and millions of dollars, it's very unlikely that your heirs will owe any estate taxes whatsoever. Right now, it's, I think, $5.25 million or something like that is the exempt amount. And so even then, even if it is $6 million, they would only owe estate taxes on the amount over the exempt amount. And so that's the good news. But where I would say you can do your heirs a big favor is not so much in terms of the estate taxes, but getting things organized so that if and when you do pass away, whoever is fortunate enough to be the beneficiary of your estate, they don't have a legal and bureaucratic and tax nightmare of trying to sort everything out and getting in. So that means not only simplifying and minimizing the complexity of the situation, but making sure that every single asset is properly designated and is part of the part of your will. And then, sadly, Robert, the longer that you live, the more likely it is that you'll have to go back and probably in about 5 years or so and update that again, because I can guarantee few things in life other than that either your situation will change or the laws will change, and it will probably be both. So it's a good idea to have an attorney who is hopefully going to be young enough to be around for the next 20 years, because you'll be seeing him or her on a 5-year basis.
What about probate?
Probate's another issue, and that can be helped by that same process of making sure things go directly to it. You do not have – the probate expense is typically the legal expense and the hassle of going through that. And anyone who's been unfortunate enough to lose a loved one and be named the executor of the estate knows what I'm talking about. You save them lots of time and money by making sure to say, okay, if I die today, what – is the process going to be to distribute this estate? And that's a good question to ask an attorney. And if they say, well, you're kind of got a mess, it's going to be several months and several billable hours, you should say, okay, I want to solve that, and I want to have everything designated so it goes quickly and easily to the person whom I intend it to go to.
Robert, thank you very much for the call, and hope you can get started with that planning, but wish you many, many years to enjoy that house in Mexico, among other things. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC, here to answer your questions on your money. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org.
My mama told me you better shop around. Thank you.
Well, it's the beginning of the fall television season, and we're going to spend some time discussing how to spend less and get more TV to watch. And Kevin, where do you want to begin with this?
Well, if it's okay with you, Joy, I think we'll start with your cable or dish bill. According to NPD Group, in 2011, the average monthly just for the cable cost, not all the other services, was $86 a month. And that's trending upward at about 6% per year. So the group said in 7 years that basic, just the cable portion of your monthly bill could approach $200 at this pace. Now, we do have more options than ever before to reduce that amount, and that's including the final option, which we will get to at the end of this segment.
So what should we do first?
Well, start with a call to your current provider and say, hey, I'm just looking for ways to save money, and I wanted to know, based on what I have, are there any packages or specials I can get so that I can still keep this awesome money flowing to you and your awesome service flowing back to me? And actually, I called our cable provider up and said, you know, I want these extra channels. How do I get them? And in a very strange twist of fate, I wasn't used to this. They said, oh, not only can you get those channels, but looking at your bill, we can save you about $60 over what you're paying right now and get you those extra channels. And I said, okay, well, that's fine. They said, how long do I have to sign the contract for? And they said, there's no contract anymore. And they said, it's month to month. And I said, fantastic. I said, this is glad to see competition actually working and these companies becoming more responsive rather than just trying to milk every single dollar out of us that they can't.
Yeah.
So you can get maybe able to lower your cost by making this call. You might be able to get more services, especially by bundling, if you're not already, your telephone, your data, internet, etc. for it. And like I said, it's much more likely now that you'll be able to get all these great discounts and services without having to sign a 5-year agreement.
Well, that's good to know. What if, though, that doesn't get you anywhere? That won't call?
Then it's time to shop around, as Barrett says. If you have Dish, contact your cable company. If you have cable, contact the Dish company and tell them where you're at and ask them what they can provide to you. And they would love to poach a customer from their rivals and would be happy to give you a very good deal. And if you still get nothing, you may want to just look going back to basic cable, which costs about $45 a month, about half of what the average cost is for all the extra channels. And you still will get a lot of your channels if you can go back to basic for a while. And if you don't like it, you can always ramp back up again to the more expensive services.
So what's the final option?
Cutting the cord completely. People who haven't checked into it are very surprised to find that they can get over-the-air broadcast in HD. They can get lots of movies and lots of TV shows over the web and then get on-demand services via the web as well. And so next week we're going to talk about how to cut the cord, the cable cord or dish cord completely, and still have more than enough television to watch.
Sounds good. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. Kevin is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, with us each week to provide information and advice on your money. If you have a personal finance question for him, we have an open line now for you at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. George and Joan sent this email. We are avid fans of your show. We just love it. We would like to get some information on self-directed IRAs. We would like to use an IRA, which is getting next to nothing in interest, to buy investment real estate. A company in New Mexico is able to handle this for us. What do you think of this option? We have other investment real estate and historically have done very well with it.
Sure. The phrase, we found a company in New Mexico, gives me a little pause. But it can be done. It's legal as long as the company is specializes in setting these up. You can't just go to your normal bank or mutual fund provider and say, hey, can I put my house in my IRA? They're not qualified to handle it. They won't handle it because there are a lot of really tricky tax and legal issues you have to handle by doing this. So hopefully you first of all have to find a company that specializes in handling these kinds of self-directed retirement accounts. Then the other issue that I have with it is that some of the tax advantages of owning real estate within an IRA are different than if you were to own it outside of an IRA. It's harder to borrow for it. It's harder to take the losses in a write-off to offset it. And then finally, the biggest issue I have with it is if they already have other real estate, they're also using their funds in their IRA that are normally in liquid non-real estate investments to also put more into real estate. So they're probably over-focusing on a particular area. Now, that could be great if they really know what they're doing and they're very confident in it, but I would be cautious. I'd like them to have lots of other paper money set up so if and when the real estate market has a downturn, their retirement is not also ruined, as will their assets outside of it. But otherwise, it's possible, and for some people, it can be a very good idea, and we'll address it in more depth in a few weeks.
All right. Thanks to George and Joan for the kind words as well. Bill in Sun Prairie is with us now. Hi, Bill.
Hello, Joy.
What's your question?
Well, my question is kind of broad-based. I'm closing in on 60. I own my own home. It's no longer the right home for me. It's got a lot of bedrooms I don't use and garage space I don't use and yard I don't really use. And I'm thinking to myself, I was going to sell and just immediately get into a condo. But I thought, you know, I started to add up the hidden costs of home/condo ownership, and I compared it to apartments. But apartments have less, if you get a decent apartment, obviously it's a formula, I guess. And what I was going to do is take my home equity out, and instead of putting it immediately into a real estate kind of floating with the market and et cetera, I was going to put it into a couple, I was going to divide it in two and give it to two financial planners and say, here's my risk analysis, or I'm risk averse or whatever, and see what I could do in the free market versus in renting a decent apartment versus putting it all down on a condo, which I'd have to stay in for probably 3 or 4 years just to be able to get the equity to pay the agency fee to sell it if I wanted to move in 4 or 5 years. Kind of a complicated question, I guess.
No, it's perfectly normal and understandable. I think you're taking a good tack. I'm not sure about the splitting it between the financial planners thing and trying to make it in the market. That much I'm not confident is going to be an issue. But let's go back to your basic one, which is, do you rent or do you buy a condo? And condos can be nice, but in terms of logistics and aesthetics, you basically get all the downsides of renting an apartment with a lot more cost. And in today's market, it's more difficult to finance it. You also have to start checking into the condo association. You have to be very aware of their financial situation, because if a condo's not doing well and you're living there, the fees are going to be sorted out amongst whoever is living there. And the fewer people live there, the more the fees are. And the more the fees are, the few people want to live there and the less value that your condo. There's several condos I know of where people own them paying more in fees than they pay on the mortgage to buy the place. And it's because it's just in such a difficult financial shape. And so, especially since this is a transition for you, I would much rather have you spend more money on a really nice apartment than buy a condo. I don't think that condos generally don't have a rapid appreciation rate, typically, because if they do make money on it, there's a lot of people selling them. They're more of a transitory than a single home or a standalone home. I don't dismiss the idea of owning a condo, but from what you told me, Bill, I'd much rather have you get a really nice apartment. You'll probably pay less money overall. You won't have to come up with a big down payment, and you'll have more flexibility to decide if this kind of living is right for you. You can stay in the apartment, and there'll always be condos for sale.
You know, that was very succinct, and it kind of flows. I don't know if you got that from me or if that's your sense overall of condos, but I certainly appreciate you buttressing my argument.
I love to buttress.
Thank you.
I'm a big buttresser.
Good luck, Bill. Thanks for calling. Next we go to Susan in Milwaukee. Hello, Susan.
Hi. Good morning. Good
morning.
My question is about rebuilding your personal credit after foreclosure. My husband and I unfortunately lost our jobs within about 6 months of each other. About 5 years ago now, and we bought a home within a reasonable price. We didn't, you know, we weren't spendthrifts. We bought within our means. We worked with our mortgage company to apprise them of the situation. We went through our savings. We went through our rainy day fund. We even went through our retirement to try to keep the home. Unfortunately, we ended up still losing the home simply because we were not able to obtain employment, and the bank wanted all of the money in arrears rather than the payment plan that we were working on. So the issue that we're having now is we went from having excellent credit to having foreclosure, and now I am personally finding myself having trouble on the job market because I worked in many years in the financial industry, and so it's being looked at as, well, your credit is not solvent, so how can we trust you to you know, to work for art organization, and I feel like I'm in between a rock and a hard place.
I'm sorry, Susan.
Yeah, and Susan, I'm glad. I'm sorry for your situation. I'm very glad you called, and the reason being is you sound like a very decent, very bright person, and this is just a demonstration that people who don't know much about how these things happen think that there's always, you know, well, they gambled the money away, or they shouldn't have gotten the mortgage in the first place. And you sound like the last people who would fit under that definition. Lots of really good, well-meaning people have been put in this situation, and more will in the future. It's one of the reasons foreclosure and bankruptcy are there, is so that people will take chances knowing that they don't have to go to debtor's prison if a situation beyond their control or even within their control put them in this situation. Now, your downside, of course, is that more employers now are using credit history as a predictor of employment, and sometimes their insurance companies require them to do that. The good news, there's two things that are good. One is that your credit will actually bounce back if you maintain the same level of discipline you have in getting out of this process in the future in terms of rebuilding your credit, just by, you know, getting some kind of secured card, building it up. It will be hopefully a matter of months and not years until you get back on this. The better news is there are millions of people in your same situation, and I would see if it's possible to get some kind of income while your credit gets built up. And I would even go back to those people who are telling you and saying, look, we'd love to hire you, but your credit doesn't fit with our parameters of what we need. And go back to them in 6 months and say, could you check my credit again? Could you check my credentials again and see if now it's a possibility that we can make it? Because if it's something that's, you know, quantifiable in terms of an actual number, the number will probably be better 6 months from now. And if it's not, they'll probably appreciate your initiative of saying, not only am I building up the weak spot of what you told me before, but I really want this job enough to go back through the humiliation of having to call you and go over this again. And I'd take whatever job you can get. And I'm serious, this will be a matter of months. People, lenders are in business to lend money, and they want to get it back. But after they know they're going to get back, they want to lend money again. And so that's why people who have a one-time a sad situation like yours, Susan, can actually get back on your feet fairly quickly. It won't seem like it while you're going through it, but after it's all done, you say, I'm glad we're over this, and I'm glad we're back up again, and it will, again, be a matter of months, not years.
Oh, Susan, thanks for the call, and I hope if you think of it that you'll call us with an update sometime down the line. Kevin, we just have time now for the website of the week.
Yeah, the website of the week is a service called BillCutters.com, and that's Cutters with a Z at the end. And what they do is you give them information on all of your bills, your cable bill, your rent, your credit cards, whatever. And then Bill Cutters contacts each one of those providers and says, hey, they know all the strategies of how to get that bill reduced, whether it's a lower interest rate or a special package for your cable bill or whatever. And then Bill Cutters' deal is they say to you, we're going to split any savings. So if you were paying $200 a month and we save you $100 a month, Bill Cutters is going to get $50 a month. Neat little service. BillCutters.com. We'll have it up at OnYourMoney.com later on today.
And four more words before we go.
Spend less. Have more.
Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, back next week for another edition of On Your Money.